From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump is warning Iran of overwhelming force if they attack anything American. He also said that could mean obliteration. This follows Iran's criticism today of the new sanctions as outrageous. A foreign ministry spokesperson said they closed the door to diplomacy. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says all options are on the table if Iran exceeds uranium enrichment limits in the 2015 nuclear deal, which it could do this week. The U.S. pulled out of that deal a year ago and reimposed economic sanctions, including that new round yesterday. Let's bring in CNN senior international correspondent Fred Pleitgen, who's in Tehran. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, and how significant is this latest rhetoric from Iranian officials today?
Well, I think it's pretty significant in that the Iranians are essentially saying that these new sanctions by the Trump administration against the supreme leader and against the military commanders is not something that's going to hurt the country per se, but they are essentially saying if this closes the door, at least in the medium term, for any sort of negotiations between the U.S. and Iran. And I think that goes back to the fundamental disconnect that you've had between Tehran and the Trump administration, where the Trump administration keeps saying they're going to sanction Iran until Iran comes back to the negotiating table, and the Iranians are saying it's precisely the sanctions that are preventing them from going back to the negotiating table.
Well, how much are the current sanctions hurting in Iran? We're hearing words like it's breaking their back. You're on the ground in Tehran. What are things like?
I think that the sanctions are having a massive effect on the economy. There's absolutely no two ways about it. And, you know, I've been going around the city here a lot, the bazaar. I've been speaking to a lot of people, and a lot of people have lost their jobs. A lot of people have lost their incomes. For a lot of people, inflation is a real problem because the currency has devalued a great deal. And then, of course, you have the problem that Iran really can't export any of its oil. But on the other hand, and people are really suffering from it, and people really at this point in time don't see how that's going to change in the medium term. But for the government and for the power structure, it seems as though they really haven't changed their way of operating. And if you look at some of the things that that senior members of the Trump administration have said, on the one hand, they say they think that the sanctions are working. On the other hand, they say that Iran is still a menace in the Middle East. And the Iranians were obviously capable of shooting down an American drone. So from that perspective, it doesn't look like it's really changed much in the way they operate. And it certainly hasn't, at least on the face of it, brought them any closer to wanting to sit down with the Trump administration.
Well, and I guess the Trump administration would say, well, those were more general economic sanctions. Now we're going after the supreme leader and the people around him. Is that likely to make any difference?
I don't think that it is. And I don't think that the Iranians believe that it is. I mean, on the one hand, the supreme leader, they say, doesn't have any assets abroad anyway. And so he doesn't seem to be very affected by it. At least that's what Hassan Rouhani said today. And then if you look at some of the others who were sanctioned, those are all senior commanders of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Those are among the most hardline loyalists to the power structure. And a lot of them are people who have been under sanctions anyway. The United States sanctioned the entire Revolutionary Guard Corps. So it's hard to see how these particular sanctions are going to stop them from doing business. On the other hand, one of the things that the Iranians keep pointing out is what I think the Secretary of the Treasury said, that they want to sanction the foreign minister of Iran. And that's one of the things that Iran's president picked up on today, where he said, look, on the one hand, you say you want Iran to go back to the negotiating table, but then you sanction Iran's top diplomat. And they say those are just two things that don't mesh.
Okay, and let's get to the nuclear issue here, because the reason that the sanctions were lifted under the Obama administration was because of the nuclear deal with Iran and a number of other countries. The U.S. pulled out of that deal. The sanctions came back. And now, just this week, Iran is set to breach the limits on enrichment of uranium that were in that deal. What is likely to happen there? And is there any chance that there will be some back channel negotiation that will convince Iran not to do that?
I think right now the Iranians are saying the only force or the only entity that could stop that from happening would be the European countries that are still part of the nuclear agreement. They're saying the Europeans need to find some sort of way to get around American sanctions to try and essentially get business with them going so they can relieve their economic situation to a certain extent. And obviously they also want to get the Europeans, as they put it, to stand up on the against the U.S. or stand up to U.S. pressure and say, look, they're going to do business with Iran anyway, despite what the Trump administration says.
In Tehran, where you are people worried about an actual military conflict with the United States?
That's one of the most fascinating things that I have found. People here are very concerned about their situation, very concerned about the economy, of course, also concerned that things between the U.S. and Iran could spiral out of control, but they're not in a state of panic. And I've been asking people why that is, especially with some of the rhetoric that they've been hearing. And they've been telling me, look, they've been going through this kind of stuff for 40 years. They've witnessed war between themselves and Iraq, a terrible war. They've had this economic pressure for a very long time. They're taking things day by day. I think when you speak to people, it seems to me as though the dire economic situation and the fact that they don't see a light at the end of the tunnel in that respect weighs on them more heavy than the potential of an armed conflict between themselves and the United States, as strange as that may sound.
That is senior international correspondent Fred Plytkin of CNN speaking with us from Tehran in Iran. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, switching gears to the domestic front, the National Center for Education Statistics reports that fewer than 40% of students in the U.S. are proficient readers. Among those struggling to read, some have undiagnosed disorders like dyslexia. And there are concerns that schools aren't identifying problems soon enough and students aren't being taught ways to help them. Well, a new law in Maryland hopes to change this, but as Jenny Ubemu of WAMU reports, some parents and educators wonder if it goes far enough.
Sarah Friedman's daughter was always behind her classmates in reading.
They were telling us, oh, she'll get there, she'll catch up.
But Friedman's daughter, who we aren't naming to protect her privacy, didn't catch up.
And at the beginning of third grade is when our daughter, she started calling herself names. I'm stupid, I'm dumb. I can't learn how to read. I'm useless, she said.
The Friedmans suspected their daughter had dyslexia, but they had to go outside the school to confirm it. Like many districts across the country, Montgomery County in Maryland did not train teachers to use the word dyslexia. District spokesperson Derek Turner says that's because the term is too broad.
If you're a doctor and you have a patient and your patient comes in with a cough, you don't immediately go to surgery, right?
Instead, the district watches for students who are struggling, then tests different methods for teaching them. But parents worry this is a band-aid approach that doesn't address the root cause of some students' issues with reading. Nationwide, researchers say as many as 20% of students may have some form of dyslexia. In Montgomery County, fewer than 4% of students are identified as having it. The numbers are similar in other districts around the country.
One of the major difficulties with schools is they don't want to know about dyslexia.
That's Sally Shaywitz, co-founder of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. She says it's not just about the label. It's about recognizing an issue and acting on it. There are plenty of research-backed ways to screen, diagnose, and treat students with various types of dyslexia, from moderate to severe, and these aren't being used in many schools.
You don't know what you have, and it gets worse and worse over time as you're in school. It breeds anxiety. Schools must screen children and must identify and intervene.
The consequences for not intervening can be dire. Students who are behind in reading are more likely to drop out of high school. That hurts their prospects for jobs and their life trajectory. Some studies have found that dyslexia and other reading disorders are more prominent amongst prisoners than the general population. It's so widespread that federal policy now requires prisons to screen for and treat dyslexia. But Montgomery County Assistant Superintendent of Special Education Kevin Lowndes says it's possible to help struggling readers without labeling them.
We do recognize that students are struggling and we want to help and support all of our students, but we've always tried to do that. We've always tried to reach all of our students.
A new law in Maryland could help Montgomery County reach more students. It requires districts to screen all kindergarten students for signs of reading disorders and then offer special instruction. This is aimed at families like the Friedmans, who eventually transferred their daughter to a private school that specializes in dyslexia. Jay Friedman is Sarah's husband.
Everything was a struggle, especially when we were asking and begging for help from the school. We could not let her go through school and not let her be able to read.
Kelly O'Keefe is with Decoding Dyslexia, a parent-led group that supported the bill. She also has daughters with dyslexia who weren't identified by Montgomery County Schools. She says the law is a good first step toward finding students who need support, but schools have to follow through.
Even when a child is identified as a struggling reader, even now, and within any public school system, really, in Maryland, the challenge is to ensure that that child receives evidence-based, appropriate intervention to truly help that child learn to read.
To provide all the services required in the new law, Montgomery County says it will need to spend almost $5 million on staff, new screening instruments, and instructional materials. There is some money set aside in the upcoming budget for a dyslexia reading specialist, but it isn't enough to fully implement the new law. Experts like Yale's Sally Shaywitz say this may mean more students are identified as struggling readers, but the law stops short of having schools identify or label the causes of students' issues. She worries that without this, some students may still not get the specialized treatment they need. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Abamu.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from EmberWave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. EmberWave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, own your temperature.
We just read a book because Steve Allman told us to read it, and we do what he says when it comes to books. And as we look at books for summer reading, you may want to consider it, too. It's John William Stoner, which was published in 1965 before that word became a noun. Stoner is William Stoner, who starts off as a taciturn farm boy in pre-World I Missouri. A county agent suggests he might be a candidate for college. His folks agree he could learn new things to help on the farm. He enrolls in the University of Missouri in 1910, makes his way there covered in red dust. I'm picturing Henry Fonda at this point, or a very young Gregory Peck. We read as Stoner falls in love with learning, becomes a teacher, an assistant professor, falls in love with a girl and their daughter. But no matter how he tries to do the right thing, the backstabbing college world, his brittle wife, they do not love him back. We wait and we wait for the happy ending, the reason for Stoner's suffering. It never comes. Stoner got glowing reviews, but only sold a few thousand copies in the 60s. Like its hero, the book seemed destined for obscurity. But then literary critics rediscovered it. C.P. Snow asked, "Why isn't this book famous?" Julian Barnes of The Guardian called it the must-read novel of 2013. The book sold over 1 million copies in Europe. Actors like Tom Hanks and Ethan Hawke are fans. Yes, there will probably be a movie. But one of the biggest fans of all, our own go-to literary guy, Steve Allman. His new book is both a deep look at Stoner, as well as an exploration of his own relationship to the book. It's called William Stoner and the Battle for the Inner Life. Steve, how many times have you reread Stoner?
Oh, gosh, probably 20.
And you, as you tell us in this book, your reading changes as you grow older and you start looking at it not just as a college student, but as a teacher, as a father, as a husband. It changes with every reading. Why? What's the attraction?
Well, the attraction of your favorite book is that it's what I think of it as is a manual for living. Nabokov has this great line about there's no such thing as reading, there's just rereading. What he means is that literature has a depth that means that each time you read it, as your inner life changes, the book becomes about something different. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned when I first picked it up in grad school, it was this book about a young farm kid who discovers literature and his soul is lit on fire. And that was me, right,
yeah.
at 28.
And professor then, says to him, "Don't you understand, son? You're in love."
Exactly, you know? That's right. He says that about teaching because
yes.
Stoner's meant to be a teacher. He's meant to transmit his love and attention for literature to his students. I loved that part of it when I was a young adjunct teaching rhetoric and composition classes to totally disinterested freshmen, right? And then, you know, I got into a number of feuds. As Robin, you know me well enough to know I will do sometimes. What? You? And then it became a book about conflict and how do we defend our rights in the world without trying to get into the opera of defending our honor.
Because Stoner has all of these feuds at work, Stoner has this kind of quiet way of saying, no, this is right. He's the guy. I mean, he's Gregory Peck. He's constantly
right.
The Gregory Peck we think we know from the movies.
Yeah, he's sort of the strong, silent type. But another way of saying it would be I call him in my book kind of the perfect martyr.
Yeah.
It's never his fault. Now, look, that's nonsense. The truth is, it is his fault. And he makes a number of terrible errors in his life. But the thing is about life, and this is what I love about Stoner Robin, we say we want happiness and contentment. That's the story we tell ourselves, but that's not true. What we really want is to feel alive in the ways that we felt alive in our childhood. And sometimes that is to be full of misery. Stoner never recovers from the guilt that he feels for leaving his parents behind, leaving the farm and going to college. And he's supposed to return to the farm, and he never does. And I believe he kind of engineers his own unhappiness. And I know through painful experience, that's how my life has been.
Yeah, yeah.
All those feuds and fights and periods of depression were, if I'm really brutally honest with myself, which is what makes Stoner a beautiful book, Stoner is brutally honest with himself, I engineered a lot of that.
Well, so there's the story itself and how it resonates. There's also the writing. Could you just give us a sense? Because John Williams, and again, it's interesting, his character is William Stoner, and there's a lot of John Williams in the character, but he talked about the plain writing.
Sure. In fact, this is the moment where William Stoner's soul comes alive. A teacher of his reads Shakespeare's 73rd sonnet, and William Stoner has no idea what it means. And here is what happens to Stoner. William Stoner realized that for several moments he had been holding his breath. He expelled it gently, minutely aware of his clothing moving upon his body as his breath went out of his lungs. Light slanted from the windows and settled upon the faces of his fellow students so that the illumination seemed to come from within them and go out against a dimness. A student blinked, and a thin shadow fell upon a cheek whose down had caught the sunlight. Stoner became aware that his fingers were unclenching their hard grip on his desktop. He turned his hands about under his gaze, marveling at their brownness, at the intricate way the nails fit into his blunt finger ends. He thought he could feel the blood flowing invisibly through the tiny veins and arteries, throbbing delicately and precariously from his fingertips through his body. I mean, imagine, Robin, that is the description in very plain English of somebody whose soul is suddenly comes alive. He's suddenly paying attention to the world around him and the world inside him.
Yeah. So there's that. But I want to get something out of the way. William Stoner's wife, Edith, is a horror. If you picture sort of Nicole Kidman in a zombie movie, she's a zombie.
Exactly.
And, you know, what's funny, what I did was I started reading your book, and then I said, I'm going to read Stoner as well, and then come back to your book for more of this analysis. And as I started reading Stoner, the novel, I thought, oh, wait a minute. I recognize this woman from women generations ago. I recognize this woman who was brought up to think that if you're just a good girl and just stay away from sex and don't get pregnant, someone will take care of you. You know, her father's a pompous bag, and I'm thinking she was abused. And I started getting very defensive about Edith.
Yep.
She is a horror, but there's reasons for it. And then I came to your chapter in which you and your wife agree.
Yes, Edith Stoner is a person, not a problem. And
yeah.
And when I was younger, I didn't think too much about Edith Stoner. I just thought she's one of the bad guys who's assailing this perfect martyr Stoner. And, you know, then getting married and sort of coming up against the incredible and intractable patterns of patriarchal thought and behavior in America, I woke up and said, hold on, Edith Stoner was completely ill-prepared for life. Her father, I believe, was abusive towards her. Her mother was emotionally and psychologically abusive. And she did not want to marry Stoner. And yet in this culture, in this time, in between the world wars, she has no choice.
You married somebody if they asked.
That's exactly it. She has to marry him. She's captive.
Well, they were both unprepared for life.
That's right. And one of the things I admire about this novel is that Williams slows down exactly where it hurts. And I'm always saying to my writing students, you know, fiction is about building a psychologically and emotionally reliable ramp to moments that really matter, when there's a lot of unbearable feeling in the room, and then slowing down.
Let's stay with it.
As civilians, we run away from those painful moments. What Williams does in Stoner is he slows down in every one of those moments where characters are in real danger, where their inner lives are set into tumult. And sometimes it's ecstatic, like when Stoner discovers that literature is going to save his life. And sometimes it's utterly brutal.
I mean, there is so much here. Look, we noticed that there's an article in the Daily Beast with the headline, famous for not being famous. Enough about Stoner.
Yeah.
It begins by saying that the time you finish reading the sentence, 17 more pieces will be published on the subject of Stoner. And here comes ours.
Yeah.
This is actually a book that has gotten a lot of love, but it's underground love.
Well, the book was really out of step. It came out in 1965. You know, you have people like James Baldwin go tell it on the mountain, and people like Saul Bellow writing with this kind of virtuosic, incredibly ornate tracking of consciousness. And here is this very plain, quiet book about an academic who's almost monkish in his devotion and the sort of private agonies and ecstasies of his life. But my argument is that it's become more and more relevant and almost revolutionary, because I believe that Americans are dying of loneliness. And I believe that it's because they've fallen out of touch with their inner life. We're kind of hurtling through time and space and information faster and faster, throwing out all these lifelines on social media, hoping that somebody will look at us and see us. And what I think we really hunger for is to see and know ourselves. But it's hard to do that. It's painful. You know, I believe that the book has a happy ending, because the redemption is that Stoner, at the end of his life, this is one of the few books that tracks a character all the way to the end of his life. He thinks about himself and he knows that he knew who he was. Mm-hmm. Maybe nobody else knows who Stoner is, but he knew who he was. He spent his time on Earth actually, even when it was, especially when it was really difficult, thinking about who he was and what he wanted to try to do, the meaningful work of trying to teach, the meaningful work of trying to have a happy marriage and trying to raise a child. And he refused to turn away in the hardest moments. And that's his form of redemption.
Well, and one of the last things the character does is pick up the book that he'd written that was kind of obscure and
yep.
nobody noticed it.
Right.
And lovingly caresses it. Yeah, he did it. He wrote that book. And I'm thinking, here we are holding the book that John Williams wrote that didn't get the notice it should have.
Yeah. I mean, but think about it. We are so mixed up about what truly is of value. We think if somebody gets fame and wealth and gets their picture on TV, that makes them important, that makes their life a success. And what Stoner is saying is, hey, from a cosmic perspective, everybody is leading a life of obscurity. We're alive for a brief span, and then we're gone. The question is, how much attention did we pay? How much love did we transmit to the world?
Mm. Steve Almond, his book, William Stoner and the Battle for the Inner Life. We'll post the introduction at hereandnow.org. We can't recommend it enough. And we also recommend the book he's writing about, the 1965 novel Stoner by John Williams. We got ours at the library. So, you know,
it.
Go to your library. Steve, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure.
In January, Courtney Irby went to a judge and asked for protection from her husband, Joseph Irby, who she said had threatened to use a knife or other weapon against her. The judge dismissed her request, and then in June, Joseph Irby was arrested. Police say he did use a weapon, his car, which he rammed into the back of her car, ultimately driving her off the road. At the time of his arrest, a judge said he couldn't carry firearms, guns, ammunition, or knives. Knowing he had guns, Courtney went and got them and brought them into the police station, explaining she was turning them over because of that injunction. Instead, she was arrested and jailed for burglary. Her story is raising a lot of questions. What is someone to do about guns they're concerned about? Gary White is with the Ledger newspaper in Lakeland, Florida. Gary, a lot of states have red flag laws. If you fear someone's use of a weapon, you can call police, get a judge to have the weapon removed. Does Florida have that?
Yes, the Florida legislature last year, after the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, did pass a law that allows for risk protection orders that has to be issued by a judge. And so in this case, that's not what was in place. The judge's order was just the pretrial release order with conditions, including that Joseph Irby could not have weapons. So it's kind of up to the person to comply.
Well, and that's exposed the sort of gray area, which Courtney Irby obviously felt she should take into her own hands. She said to the officer when she brought the guns in, "So you're telling me you committed an armed burglary?" And she said, "Yes, I am." But he wasn't going to turn them in, meaning her estranged husband. And so I'm doing so. Is that part of the conversation now? who does enact that injunction that somebody not be around guns when they've been ordered to do so by a judge?
Yes, it does seem to be a bit of a gray area. And I've been trying to find out that if call into Lakeland Police Department to follow up on this to see if she had just called them and said, the judge issued this order, I don't think he's going to comply with it, will you go take his guns away, if they would have been authorized to do so. As far as I can tell, they would not have been. There has to be a risk protection order issued by a judge, so a separate order would have had to come out. So yeah, it does seem to be a bit of a gray area.
Well, meanwhile, they're both now going to be arraigned on July 16th. She for taking, you know, armed burglary, taking the guns from a home. He for attacking her. He's accused of attacking her with his car. She spent 6 days in the Polk County Jail. What's been the reaction there?
There's been a strong reaction to this story, as far as I can tell, mostly sympathetic to her and critical of Lakeland Police Department, although, of course, there are quite a few people who say she broke the law and deserved to be arrested. And a state legislator from Orlando yesterday called for the state attorney's office to drop any prosecution of Ms. Irby. And there's also been a GoFundMe campaign started to raise money for her legal defense.
That's reporter Gary White with the Ledger newspaper there in Lakeland, Florida. We'll continue to follow this story to see what happens here. Lots of questions raised. And, you know, one of them, I'm sure, is women's groups are saying, why should she trust the system? She went to the courts in January asking for protection and didn't get it.
Right.
Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared shortly after it took off from Kuala Lumpur on its way to Beijing on March 8, 2014. There were 239 people on board, including the pilot, co-pilot, 10 flight attendants, and 227 passengers. Many have tried since the disappearance to find out what happened. Writer William Longavisha is one of them. He's got an extensive piece in the latest issue of The Atlantic and joins us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with what is known about MH370. It is presumed to have crashed into the Indian Ocean. How do we know that?
We know that with great certainty because we know what the track of the airplane was with quite a lot of precision. And we also have found, we collectively have found wreckage on the shores of East Africa. We haven't found the main wreckage in deep waters in the Indian Ocean. But we certainly have seen debris coming from that airplane washing ashore.
We haven't found the main wreckage despite extensive searches.
More than 2.5 years, primarily by the Australians, a huge effort, and still so far, nothing.
So one of the things that you point out is that one of the first signs of trouble was when the plane moved out of the Malaysian airspace. It should have checked in. The pilots should have checked in then with the next country, which I believe was Vietnam, right?
Yeah, they were flying straight for Beijing, just pretty much north out of Kuala Lumpur. They came to the edge of official Malaysian airspace, and they were handed off to Ho Chi Minh City, mm-hmm. Vietnam, and they never came up on the new frequency. What happened immediately at that point was that the transponder, they basically the signal dropped off the radar screens, and the airplane as a primary target turned left by more than 90 degrees and turned away from Beijing and started its complex escape route.
Is there any explanation for that?
We pretty much know, not in detail. I mean, the exact motive is not known. It probably will never be known unless the Malaysians open up a little bit more than they have. But we know it was a psychological issue.
A psychological issue by the main pilot on that flight.
The captain.
Mm-hmm. And how do we know that?
There are various ways we know it. First of all, through a process of elimination. Once you are very familiar with the technicalities of what happened to that airplane, you realize, first of all, that it was a human act. It's impossible that any imaginable series of failures could have caused the airplane to do what it did, that this was an intentional act. And then you go through the process of elimination. Well, who would have the intent? And you eliminate and eliminate and eliminate And you finally come, as one captain there in Malaysia said to me, 777 captain, a friend of the man, said that you finally get to the top of the pyramid. And unfortunately, it was my friend. It's one person wide. There it is. There's another reason, which is that there were various official investigations that were run by the Malaysians, mm-hmm. and Malaysia being a very corrupt, very secretive country at that time and still today, the police investigation was wholly inadequate. We know that the military was censoring the report. They were hiding things, but the police was the worst part of it because they painted a picture of the captain that was completely not true. If Malaysia were a different kind of country and the police painted a sort of healthy picture of the captain, that would have some weight. In this case, it has sort of the opposite of weight. Why are they going out of their way to paint the picture of the captain in ways which we know are the opposite of the truth?
Why do you think that they would do that?
Avoiding political embarrassment. It's not sure that they were covering up something that they knew about. It's possible that they were covering up something that they didn't know about, and they were afraid of what they would find out or what others would find out. Who knows what the motivations of a system like the Malaysian system are, but they're complicated and dark.
By the way, the captain was not the only person in the cockpit. Do you have a sense that he killed the co-pilot?
No, I have no sense of that at all. I think we all know that the co-pilot was eliminated and probably not by being killed in the cockpit. More likely, he just excused himself to use the bathroom and was locked out. That's the standard system to become alone in a cockpit. So it's very likely that the co-pilot was not involved in this and that he was excluded somehow politely from the cockpit.
And just one more question about the actual act itself. It sounds from your reporting like what you believe and what many people believe is that the passengers on the plane would have simply died when the pilot took it up to an altitude that was not sustainable for life, basically without the amount of oxygen you would need up there.
Well, it's a pressurized airplane, so mm-hmm. even at the cruising altitude, they were at 37,000, something like that. We believe they pulled up to 40,000 with the first left turn, and that associated with that climb was a depressurization of the airplane. He threw a switch. So he depressurized the airplane, slapped a pressure oxygen mask on himself, and there are mm-hmm. four of them in the cockpit, and let the other one's masks descend automatically from the ceilings. But those are not pressure systems. They're designed for short use during a rapid descent to a lower, much lower altitude, and that airplane never descended. Mm-hmm.
Now, you introduce us in this article to a man named Blaine Gibson, who has conducted a very thorough investigation or a very personal investigation into what happened to MH370. Who is he?
Amazing story. He's a lawyer by training from Seattle. His father was the Chief Justice of California for years, decades. And Blaine Gibson has been traveling the world all his life and living on a small inheritance, an adventurer, an explorer. And he decided he was going to start searching beaches for debris. He went to Australia, talked to some oceanographers who were doing drift analysis, and they recommended he go to certain places in Madagascar and Mozambique. He started with Mozambique and right away found the first piece.
Mm-hmm. And he would pay the locals basically to call him and tell him if they found anything else.
He set up networks. The networks are still very active. It's still going on now. So yes, he would pay local fishermen and villagers in remote areas of East Africa, and he started harvesting these pieces, quite a few of them.
Does the wreckage offer any clues as to what happened to the plane?
Yes, it does. We know that there's no sign of fire. There's no sign of a missile strike. And the wreckage is very small. In other words, we know that the airplane hit hard. This was not an intentional water landing. This was a spiral dive that ended up with a horrific contact with the sea that shattered the airplane and turned it into confetti.
Now, there is some criticism of your conclusions. One of the MH370 investigating officers tells the New Straits Times, which is a Malaysian newspaper, that your article is baseless and not constructive. What do you say in response to that?
There's no response to that. The article is based on very, very careful work and a lifetime in aviation. You'd have to ask yourself, how credible is the critic, mm-hmm. especially if somebody like that, an investigator, that we know the investigation was in one way or another a cover-up. That's not surprising. It's Malaysia.
It's Malaysia, but they were helped by other countries like Australia. Did the Australians get involved and say, look, we've got to be more transparent about what's going on here?
They tried that. There was a lot of tension between the Australians and the Malaysians. The Australians were really running the search in the mm-hmm. in the South Indian Ocean, so they were basically at sea. They had to do a lot of analysis, and they did a great analysis of the electronic signals to know roughly where to look. They were not happy with the Malaysians, and Malaysians were not happy with the Australians, and there was not a lot of communication going on, even within Malaysia. The police weren't talking to the technical investigators, the Army or the Air Force wasn't talking to the police, and there were big divisions within the Malaysian investigation. Then you had people like the American NTSB who came in, very, very competent people, and they were excluded from the very beginning. And they can't really say that because there are all sorts of standards about what they cannot say or can say when they're officially assisting a foreign investigation. So their hands are tied or their mouths are taped, but they did not get a warm reception, put it that way.
Do you think that the rest of the wreckage and even the black boxes will ever be found, and will it make a difference if they are?
I have no way of knowing that. I suppose if you spend enough money and look long enough, it can be found. Is it worth finding is the question. And I suspect, not knowing, of course, but I suspect that the answer is no. I mean, we already know what happened. And we know that we know what the airplane did. We know it was an intentional act. And what else are we going to learn, especially in the cockpit voice recorder? Of course, we're going to, which is a two-hour closed-loop recording. I mean, you're just, unless the guy is talking for the last 2 hours. The airplane flew for 7 hours after it turned away from Beijing, mm-hmm. stayed in the air for 7 hours. So probably we're going to have nothing there.
You think he was alive that whole time?
I have no way of knowing that.
That is William Longavisha, whose story about MH370 is in the July edition of The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
And you can read William's article for yourself at hereandnow.org.
California's county jails are some of the country's worst. Up to 70% of the population is either mentally or physically ill. Attacks on guards have increased 90% over the last 10 years, partly because some inmates hope it will get them transferred to federal prison, that actually prefer a longer sentence in the state penitentiary than a stay in the county jail. One of the most troubled is the Men's Central Jail in Los Angeles. The ACLU calls it a dungeon. And in February, the LA Board of Supervisors voted to replace it with a mental health treatment center. So is that an overdue step in the right direction or a ticking time bomb straight out of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Terry Coopers is a psychiatrist and professor emeritus at the Wright Institute. In 2009, he wrote a report for the ACLU about Men's Central. So, Dr. Coopers, describe what you saw. What goes on inside Men's Central?
Well, Men's Central Jail is, first of all, massively crowded, so that cells built for two people holds four or six. Dormitories can hold well over 100 people, where it's impossible for the officers to supervise because they really can't see what's going on. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of sexual assaults that are going on in back rows of bunks in dormitories that are too difficult to manage. As you mentioned, the percentage of prisoners with serious mental illness is sky high. Some people put it at 30%. Some people put it at 70%. It's somewhere in between. There are 10 times as many people with serious mental illness in our jails and prisons today as there are in our psychiatric hospitals.
Well, why is this, by the way? Are people more sick outside of jail and doing things that are landing them in jail? Are they being made mentally ill in jail?
Well, it's both. And we have a long history, four decades now, of deinstitutionalization. That is, the state hospitals, and this is nationwide, have been closing or downsizing. What's going on in the meantime that gets little publicity is that the budget for public mental health services has been slashed repetitively. So there's very little in the way of public mental health treatment. There's insufficient housing. There's a big problem with substance abuse. So what we have is a large population in the community of people with serious mental illness who are receiving inadequate treatment. A certain number are locked up, essentially disappearing the problem of lack of public mental health services. And then in the jails and prisons, they become either victims or they get into trouble because they break rules and they get sent to solitary confinement. There's a very high rate of suicide, and the problem gets worse from there.
The Board of Supervisors seems to recognize this is a crisis, right? They want to tear down Men's Central and build this new facility with a mental health component. You and others are very much against this because of what, the centralized nature of it? What's your objection?
When we look at the plans for the mental hospital, the rooms look essentially like jail cells. And what they're setting up is a massive institution that we really don't have the capacity to run. It harkens back to the worst days of the asylum with these huge facilities where nobody really knows the patients and abuses multiply. So I am strongly in favor of switching the money from the sheriff's department. We shouldn't have a jail. Give it to the Department of Mental Health and Public Health and set up alternative programs in the community, which are the most effective at dealing with the mental illness and the substance abuse problems. The statistics are that people who go into a program in the community have a 60 or 80% chance of becoming clean and sober after a three-year period and have a much more positive prognosis in terms of their mental illness.
Well, you're talking about addicts. But what do you say to people who say, well, wait, you know, the mental health component is just one part of why somebody is in jail? What about the fact that they did something wrong and should be punished for that? You can't do that in a treatment center. Well, what about they, you know, they may be more dangerous, which is why they were behind bars?
Well, the danger is actually not a factor. The individuals, prisoners who are dangerous are very few and far between, and they will not be diverted to the community. They will be held in jail. So that's sort of a false argument. We need to make sure, instead of guaranteeing that the punishment is harsh enough to fit the crime, which I think is a large part of the public discussion, that what we do to people in jail and prison doesn't make them more likely to suffer mental illness, to recidivate and do further crimes, or to return to drugs. That should be our guiding principle. So what I propose is the LA Board of Supervisors and everyone else, all other legislative bodies, look at which programs are successful, and some are amazingly successful, and then increase their funding so they can take care of more individuals. And that's where the population who otherwise would have been in jail can then go.
That's Dr. Terry Coopers, psychiatrist, professor emeritus at the Wright Institute, and is against plans to build a new mental health facility to replace the county jail there in Los Angeles. He says, spread the funds out and spread the care out. Dr. Coopers, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.